Iran's fully indigenous Sahand frigate and Macron floating base are back in the Persian Gulf after more than 4 months of sailing that took them as far as the northern end of the Atlantic Ocean, over a distance of 44,000 kilometers. The naval crew were warmly welcomed by senior military officials, who feel proud that Iran's navy is now capable of sailing in the high sea for extended periods.
We passed through three oceans, the Indian Ocean, the South Atlantic, and North Atlantic Ocean. On the way, we passed through rough seas and finally arrived in Russia's St. Petersburg port. We then sailed all the way back home. All the mission took us some 4.5 months. This is the farthest point we have ever sailed to.
Sahand Frigate is a radar evading vessel that's equipped with torpedo launchers and electronic warfare technologies. And Macron Floating Base is a support vessel that's fitted with a large helicopter pad. Sahand and Macron departed from the Persian Gulf in early May. The two ships passed by Cape of Good Hope, rounded Africa, and sailed through the North Atlantic Ocean to reach Russia, all without docking for refueling on the way.
Throughout our journey, we did not stop to refuel or recharge our medical or food supplies. We went straight to our destination. We had our support vessel Macron along with Sahand that refueled it along the way. It sends a strong message to our enemies, especially the U.S., which tried to play down our naval might.
Iran's defense sector has been under 4 decades of U.S.-led arms embargoes. Iranian officials say they have viewed the sanctions as an opportunity to gain self-sufficiency in the industry. Iran now claims that it has indigenized more than 80% of its arsenal, from drones and helicopters to warships and submarines.
The Iranian Navy is back from the longest voyage in its history. To Iran, sailing through the Atlantic Ocean was a game changer for 2 reasons. First, it shows that the country can rely on its domestically built equipment for tough naval missions amid U.S. arms embargoes. And most importantly, it adds Iran to the short list of countries with a blue water navy. Yusuf Jalali from the Persian Gulf.
Abu Ubaida, spokesman for the Izzeddin al-Qassam Brigades, the military wing of Hamas, pledged in a speech to release the prisoners who were rearrested after escaping from an Israeli jail on Monday. He also stressed that the rearrest of the prisoners does not hide the extent of shame Israel is going through, as Palestinian inmates have shaken their security system reputation.
No prisoner swap deal will be made without the release of our heroic prisoners who were rearrested by the occupation forces. We promise our inmates that they will be liberated soon within the no swap deal. Our inmates have exposed the fragility of the security of the enemy.
Immediately after Abu Ubaida's speech, Palestinian resistance fired rockets toward the occupied lands to show that they are ready to face the Israeli regime and defend Palestinians. In response, the Israeli airplane launched an airstrike on the Gaza Strip.
The Palestinian resistance has achieved many goals. First, it succeeded in forcing the Israeli regime out of Gaza. Second, it demolished the Zionist thought of having this land for themselves. Israeli violations and attacks against Palestinians will never terrify us.
In conjunction with this, the resistance factions held a national conference, stressing the importance of the resistance.
The clashes with this Israeli regime will persist. The regime can never feel secure as long as it steals our rights and kills our people. We will never leave our prisoners alone, and the resistance will set them free.
On Saturday evening, the rearrested prisoners appeared at the Israeli court in the city of Nazareth to extend their detention while being deprived of having a lawyer. Palestinians here stress on supporting the Palestinian detainees in Israeli jails and considering them the symbol of the Palestinian issue. Palestinian factions believe that the resistance is the only way to get their rights back. Ruba Shabit, Gaza.
Hezbollah Secretary General Said Hassan Nasrallah said on Monday that the first Iranian fuel shipment has reached the Banias port in Syria and will be transported by land to Lebanon this week.
The transport of fuel from Syria to the Bekaa begins Thursday, and it will be stored in specific tanks, and a second ship will arrive in Bayez within a few days. The third ship, which I have mentioned before, has been prepared. All managerial prerequisites have been accomplished, so the vessel will be ready to sail. We're also preparing the logistics for the fourth shipment. About a month later, we'll see if we need a fifth or sixth ship. I have to clarify that we don't seek any gains on this fuel. We prefer all Lebanese and everyone who lives in Lebanon.
In his Talvi speech, Sayyid Nasrallah noted that Hezbollah will offer a one-month fuel donation to state-run hospitals, nursing homes, orphanages, disability centers, state-run water institutions, municipalities that have water wells, the civil defense, and the Lebanese Red Cross. Experts believe the speech highlights a roadmap Hezbollah has put forth to alleviate the fuel crisis the Lebanese people are dealing with, in light of the government's inactivity, and at the same time, challenges pressures imposed by the West against the nation.
Hezbollah's decision to bring in fuel and even warn the enemies that it will be considered Lebanese assets and that any strike on the ships will lead to retaliation was a very influential issue. It dealt a blow to the U.S. sanctions, whether against Iran, Syria, or Lebanon. The fact that the ship has reached its destination safely and has unloaded its cargo is in itself a victory.
The Hezbollah chief stressed that the resistance's deterrence power kept the ship safe. He said once the shipment reaches its destination, the fuel will be distributed carefully to prevent any potential profit seekers from taking advantage. Lebanon has been sleeping in the dark for many nights. Sayyid Nasrallah has stressed that Hezbollah's initiative to bring in fuel to Lebanon from Iran will not only bring electricity, it will also break the current U.S. sanctions against the country. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
In the limelight.
The planetary crisis is impacting a broad range of rights, including the rights to adequate food, water, education, housing, health, development, and even life itself, said the UN's top rights expert. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Julia Conley, journalist. This article is published under the heading Environmental Threats Rapidly Becoming Single Greatest Challenge to Human Rights, UN says. Stay tuned for more. The climate crisis and other environmental calamities are quickly becoming the greatest threat to human rights across the globe, the United Nations top rights expert said recently. At the 48th session of the UN Human Rights Council, High Commissioner Michelle Bachelet warned that the triple planetary crises of climate change, pollution, and nature loss is directly and severely impacting a broad range of rights, including the rights to adequate food, water, education, housing, health, development, and even life itself. Bachelet's comments came weeks after UN identified Madagascar's current hunger crisis as quickly becoming the world's first famine driven almost entirely by the climate crisis, as the heating of the planet has caused the country's years-long drought. Extreme and major climate events have been recorded in regions across the world, Bachelet said, pointing to record-breaking rainfall and flash flooding in countries including Germany, Turkey, and China, an Arctic heat wave that scientists linked to a cold snap in North America that led to a deadly deep freeze and power outage in Texas, and interminable drought across much of the world that has displaced millions. The said crises are intensifying conflicts in places including Northern Africa's Sahel region, where desertification and long droughts, often followed by dangerous flash flooding, have run up against weak governance of natural resources, long-standing patterns of poverty and inequalities, inadequate access to basic services, and high rates of youth unemployment and discrimination against minorities, women and girls. These trends compel people into displacement, aggravate conflicts and political instability, and fuel recruitment by violent extremist groups, said Bachelet, adding, in such a situation, it should be clear that there can be no purely military solution to the conflicts in the region. Environmental threats have led to displacement of 4 million people across the Sahel region, according to the UN, with the Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, OCHA, saying the area is facing an exceptional crisis. The commissioner also identified countries including China, India, and Bangladesh as facing widespread disaster displacement, with 20 million people in Bangladesh expected to be forced from their homes by 2050 as 17% of the country becomes submerged by rising sea levels. Forecasts of this gravity and impact, including on displacement, cannot be ignored by any policymaker anywhere, Bachelet said. They will have cascading economic, social, cultural, and political effects that will impact every society in the world. In addition to the long-term effects of drought and the heating of the planet driven by continued fossil fuel extraction, the commissioner noted that air pollution fueled by same patterns of unsustainable consumption and production as climate change is responsible for an estimated 1 in 6 of all premature deaths around the world. The 33 countries found to be at extremely high risk for hazards, including air pollution. According to a report issued by UNICEF last month, emit only 9% of global carbon emissions and are home to 2.2 billion children, meaning those countries least responsible for the climate crisis are most at risk for human rights threats it is causing. As Bachelet made her statement on the climate emergency's effect on human rights, Amnesty International joined more than 1,000 civil society groups in calling on the Human Rights Council to recognize a safe, clean, healthy, and sustainable environment as a universal human right. Governments' failure to act on climate change in the face of overwhelming scientific evidence may well be the biggest intergenerational human rights violation in history, said Agnes Callamard, Secretary General of Amnesty International, adding, as the primary global human rights body, the HRC must use all the tools at its disposal to counter the crisis. We call on all the states to support recognition of the right to a healthy environment at the UN and at national level. Those who do not will be on the wrong side of history and standing against the common future of humanity. Bachelet looked ahead to the 2021 UN Climate Change Conference, COP26, taking place in Glasgow, Scotland in November, where she said she will be strongly advocating more ambitious, rights-based and inclusive climate action. The Commissioner's statement amplified a call from more than 100 nations in the Global South earlier this year, in which government officials and experts demanded $100 billion in climate financing and net zero emissions targets, with end dates well before 2050, in order to take responsibility for rich nations' disproportionate role in causing the planetary emergency. Bachelet said, States' human rights obligations require them to cooperate toward a progressive realization of human rights globally, and this clearly should include adequate financing by those who can best afford it of climate change mitigation, adaptation, and loss and damage.
Why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed? Smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of God. Welcome to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. This program, Islamic Laws, we are going to deal with the laws related to taqlid or following mujtahid according to Ayatollah Sistani. Before that, let's take a listen to a short biography.
The grand Ayatollah Sistani comes from the family of scholars and pious men. He learned theological and rational sciences from many eminent and well-known religious scholars. At the age of 5, His Eminence started learning the Holy Quran. He was then admitted in a religious center for reading, writing, and for learning basic mathematics and geography. In the beginning of 1360 Hijri, he started studying basic Hausa lessons. He also studied a number of books on philosophy, like Sharh Manzumah Sabzawari and Sharh Ishraq. Meanwhile, he attended Kharij lectures by the late Mirza Mehdi Ashtiani and the late Mirza Hashim Qazwini. In the late 1368 Hijri, he migrated to Qum to accomplish his studies in Fiqh and Usul. His Eminence left Qum for Najaf al-Ashraf. On having arrived in Najaf, he began attending Qayatullah Khoi and Sheikh Hussain Hilli's lectures in jurisprudence and the fundamentals of jurisprudence. In 1380 Hijri, Ayatollah Sistani traveled back to his hometown, the holy city of Mashhad, expecting to stay and settle down there. In the same year, he was awarded a permit by Imam Al-Khoi and another by Sheikh Hilli, certifying that he had attained the level of ijtihad, that is, deduction of legal judgment in matters of religion.
Well, as I've said, we are going to delve into some of the laws related to taqlid or following a religious authority, a mujtahid, according to Ayatollah Sistani. When it comes to taqlid and the other things which are hovering around it, like, for example, a woman being subject to her husband, when it comes to taqlid, is the same woman subject to her husband in terms of taqlid as well? Should she follow the same mujtahid as her husband?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, there are some people who believe that in order for the family to maintain cohesion and unity, mm-hmm. the husband and the wife both should follow the same religious authority. But this is not the right proper understanding of the concept of taqlid.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, the husband and the wife are two individuals who can follow two different religious authorities depending.
So they are independent in terms of taqlid.
They are independent. And of course, it depends largely on who the religious authority, who the qualified religious authority is mm-hmm. in his or in her opinion or according to the legal experts, you know,
right?
Because it's not my point of view as an individual, as mm-hmm. an ordinary person. It's not my opinion that matters. It is the opinion of a qualified scholar who can give his expert opinion about a given mujtahid being qualified or not.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, if the husband comes to know that a certain mujtahid is the most qualified mujtahid, then he should follow him. And if the wife actually comes to the conclusion after conducting research and after coming to know that a certain mujtahid, maybe that mujtahid could be different and different and from a different country, from a different, let's say, territory,
right?
She can follow that mujtahid. Okay,
mm-hmm.
So it's not actually necessary for the two people to follow the same religious authority.
Right. Of course, when you say that doing the taqlid or following a religious authority, usually what comes with the territory is that we are talking about a very well-known religious authority and also somebody who's like more knowledgeable than the other ones,
sure,
right?
Sure, sure. That's
coming to the topic of taqlid, is taqlid or following religious authority obligatory? Or when does it become obligatory or necessary to perform taqlid of a mujtahid or following a religious authority?
Well, taqlid becomes obligatory when a person is unable to exercise precaution. You
mm-hmm.
know, there are three main choices or three options which one must opt for. Either a person has to be a mujtahid himself,
mm-hmm.
okay, or he should act on precaution. And if a person is unable to act on precaution, and he is not a mujtahid himself,
mm-hmm.
He must follow a mujtahid. And of course, in modern time, and especially in this time, it is neither necessary to be for a person to be a mujtahid, okay? Because if there is one mujtahid, or if there are a few mujtahids
mm-hmm.
who undertake the responsibility to infer Islamic laws from the authoritative mm-hmm. sources such mm-hmm. as the Quran and the Sunnah,
yes.
then it is actually sufficient. And others are not supposed to become mujtahid, okay? So becoming a mujtahid and then exercising precaution are two different obligations, are two different things, which are difficult, pretty difficult for everyone, you
mm-hmm.
see. Because if a person wants to act on precaution, mm-hmm. he has to know different aspects of an issue. For example, the issue may be the issue of taqlid, or maybe the issue of salat or hajj, or different. And there are different disciplines within
yes.
the Islamic legal, within the Islamic jurisprudence.
Mm-hmm.
There are different chapters which a person must study. In order to be able to act on precaution, one has to actually study the pros and cons and all the different aspects of an issue
I
in
see.
Order to fully
yes.
comprehend and understand and what is actually precautionary and what's not precautionary.
Right.
And therefore, it's not advised. It's not advised, nor is it recommended, actually. It's not recommended by anyone to act in precaution. The safest place, the safest option, and the best option, of course, is to follow a mujtahid, because that mujtahid is actually an expert in this field of Islamic jurisprudence.
Okay, thank you very much. Let's take a break, and we'll be back after this.
Sure.
The Office of Ayatollah Sistani is currently providing the following services. 1. Board of Istifta, replying to religious questions. 2. Helping the poor, needy, homeless, and those who have suffered losses by earthquakes and floods. 3. Sending books for people who want to understand and learn Islam. 4. Hajj delegation. 5. Sending preachers. Board of Istifta is a link between Ayatollah Sistani and people. It provides them with answers to questions pertaining to religious, ideological, social, and educational matters in accordance with the verdicts and rulings of Ayatollah Sistani. For more information, visit the website of Ayatollah Sistani at www.sistani.org. You can also ask your questions through the following email, english@sistani.org.
Back to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. Sheikh Javid, there are some people who pray without following a religious authority, without doing the taqlid of the kind that we know of. What happens to their prayers? What happens to their supplications or any other religious or ritual services that they do, like praying, like worship, like fasting, hajj, etc., etc.? Are they valid?
Well, that's a very good question, because we do know that there are many people out there who do not follow a mujtahid, either because they have no information about the necessity of doing taqlid, or they are deliberately ignoring this obligation and not doing taqlid of a mujtahid, because they think that the Book of God and, of course, and reading the Quran and also the understanding the Sunnah is sufficient. For example, everybody can understand the Quran, and everybody can understand the Sunnah of the Prophet, the sayings and the tradition of the Holy Prophet, and therefore it's not obligatory for people to follow a mujtahid. This is just a misconception on the part of some people. Well, to be honest, if a person happens to pray and to pray according to the fatwa of the most knowledgeable and the most qualified mujtahid, and his actions, his prayers, acts of worship, like fasting or doing pilgrimage, all of these acts of worship happen to be according to the fatwa of the mujtahid, then it is sufficient. And it's not necessary for him to repeat his prayers. It's not necessary for him to actually redo his acts of worship. Because what is actually important is to do the a'mal, do the wajibat, the acts of obligations, the obligatory duties, and to stay away from haram things according to the verdicts of the most qualified mujtahid. And of course, in doing all these things, one does not need to make niyyah of a given mujtahid, okay? Because niyyah or forming your intention is not necessary in the first place.
Right.
If you just know that, let's say that a given mujtahid has this and that fatwa, and he says this and that, that's sufficient. It's not necessary to just make your intention clear and to form your niyyah or your intention about following a mujtahid. If your actions happen to be according to his to the verdict of the most qualified mujtahid, that is sufficient, and you don't need to do anything again.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. That was the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. Thank you very much for listening to us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Looking up at the sky, searching for Allah Most High, He rejected the way of worshipping gods of clay. Prophet Ibrahim knew that Allah was near, and that the heart of a Muslim is sincere. Under the hot burning sun, he declared God is one. Though with stones on his chest, his iman would not rest. The Mu'adhin knew that right will conquer wrong, and the heart of a Muslim must be strong. It's the heart of a Muslim through the guidance of Islam that makes you fair and kind and helpful to your fellow man. So living as a Muslim means that you must play a part. Allah looks not at how you look, but what is in your heart.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 15:20 to 16:20 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz, every day from 19:20 to 20:20 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
On Sunday, North Korea said it has successfully test-fired a new long-range cruise missile over the weekend, the first missile launch by the country since March. According to North Korea's official news agency, KCNA, The missiles deployed during the test flew 1,500 kilometers before hitting their designated targets inside the country's territorial waters. In response, the United States military accused North Korea of posing threats to Pyongyang's regional neighbors and the international community. The North Korean outlet, however, described the new missile as having strategic significance, which will help the country counter aggression from foreign forces. The announcement has led experts to speculate that the missiles are nuclear capable, but so far, it's unclear whether Pyongyang has perfected the technology needed to make warheads small enough to fit into cruise missiles.
The new technique and strategy has been sanctions, has been chastising DPRK for having a defensive nuclear program that has never been launched. It's not the DPRK that has launched nuclear war against Japan. They didn't launch the atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. It was the U.S. imperialists who did so.
The agency called the weapon a key element in a five-year plan outlined in January to further advance the nuclear-armed country's defense science and arsenals. It added that the development of the most recently tested missiles took 2 years to complete. Former U.S. President Donald Trump took an unusual approach in his North Korea policy. He began his tenure by issuing threats, warning Pyongyang of, quote, fire and fury.
He has been very threatening beyond a normal statement. And as I said, they will be met with fire, fury, and frankly, power, the likes of which this world has never seen before.
In June 2018, however, Trump met North Korean leader Kim Jong-un in Singapore, an event that marked the first ever meeting between the two countries' leaders. The two officials met once again in Hanoi, Vietnam, in February 2019 to discuss denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula and the lifting of U.S. sanctions, as well as a halt to joint military exercises conducted by Washington and its allies near North Korea, maneuvers that Pyongyang considers provocative and a national security threat. The summit, however, broke down without any tangible results. In the meantime, ties between China and the U.S. deteriorated since the president took office in 2018. The Trump administration took the country into a trade war with China, imposing billions of dollars worth of tariffs on Chinese imports.
It's not racist at all, no, not at all. It comes from China.
Trump's anti-China rhetoric escalated after the COVID-19 pandemic broke out, worsening the already frigid ties between Washington and Beijing. Many observers expected the Biden era to mark a departure from Trump's hawkish policies. Weeks into his presidency, however, the Biden administration announced new sanctions against China and threatened North Korea with military action.
Under the Biden administration, we're not going to see much headway into peace between the DPRK and the U.S., because ultimately what this comes down to is China. The U.S. wants to colonize and expand its presence on the Korean Peninsula to annex North Korea DPRK so that it can use it as a base of aggression and platform against China.
It appears that Biden has chosen the same approach toward countries the U.S. deems as its adversaries as Trump did. But wouldn't the same approach to solving a problem always produce the same result?
Alleged September 11th mastermind Khaled Sheikh Mohammed and four others appeared in a military courtroom at Guantanamo Bay in Cuba for the first time since the coronavirus pandemic began. 20 years after the attacks, the U.S. military is still in the pretrial phase of persecution of the suspects. The five are accused of war crimes in the 9/11 attacks that killed nearly 3,000 people 2 decades ago. If found guilty, they face execution. Meanwhile, human rights advocates say the trial is full of legal obstacles and it may never reach a satisfactory conclusion. The defense attorneys have tried to challenge the military commission's legitimacy to overturn the case by arguing that the CIA tortured the detainees in a secret prison before transferring them to Guantanamo. The defendants' lawyers accused the U.S. government of bringing the five suspects to Guantanamo Bay to continue covering up torture. They said the government's secrecy about the use of torture is the main reason that indefinite detention still exists at Guantanamo Bay since its establishment, the notorious prison has been under fire for the so-called enhanced interrogation methods used on inmates to force them to confess to crimes they might not even have committed. Interrogation methods which international human rights advocates say amounted to torture.
Primarily because it's designed to be an institution through which the U.S. Subverts the law, through which the U.S. Is able to commit torture, is able essentially to go beyond what is usually permissible. So questions such as the one that you posed, while it is irrelevant in an ordinary set of circumstances, in an ordinary concept of the rule of law, the blunt answer is the rule of law and judicial process and the implementation of any judicial process for the U.S. at least is irrelevant when it comes to Guantanamo Bay, or at least not a priority.
Experts say at the rate the case is proceeding, there could be another decade of procedural hearings. The Guantanamo Bay Prison, also known as Gitmo, was established in southern Cuba in January 2002 to hold inmates in a place neither U.S. nor international law applied. Since then, Guantanamo has been synonymous with human rights abuses perpetrated by the U.S. government in the name of terrorism. At its peak, over 700 inmates have been held in the facility. However, only 7 have been convicted, including 5 as a result of pretrial agreements under which they pleaded guilty in return for a possibility of releasing from the base. Currently, nearly 40 inmates are incarcerated in Guantanamo without any charges. They're stuck in legal limbo, languishing there for nearly 2 decades. That's while their proceedings have been delayed at the pretrial estate for several years. That justifies why Guantanamo Bay Prison is a symbol of lingering U.S. injustice. And while the Biden administration has said it wants to close the facility, the prison officials have confirmed that a $15 million expansion is underway, including the construction of a new courtroom and workspaces.
Well, it's only because of the power of the United States that it can continue to operate. It's clearly in violation of international law. And people are held without charge in many cases. And so it's just been a travesty, a disaster, a catastrophe for the people involved in it. And again, it's clearly not legal for the United States government to do this, to pick up people anywhere in the world, and then to hold them indefinitely, to abuse them, waterboard them, torture them in other ways, and consign them to what seems to be endless imprisonment.
With the prisoners stuck in a legal limbo, an international outcry against torture and injustice, the Guantanamo Bay prison continues to operate. It looks highly unlikely that Joe Biden will manage to remove what human rights advocates call a stain on America's global image. Following the 9/11 terrorist attacks, the U.S. administration led by then-President George W. Bush declared a war on terror and invaded Afghanistan in October 2001. 20 years later, the chaotic withdrawal of U.S. troops from Afghanistan marked the end of a protracted war that cost thousands of lives and trillions of dollars. 20 years of intervention in order to protect Afghanistan and to build a decent defensive military force for the nation. However, Kabul's pack of cards collapsed as the Taliban took over the country with no trouble. Afghanistan is a perfect example of the U.S. hegemony and military presence under the pretext of fighting terrorism. A big failure for a nation that feels it has to police the world. As of July 2021, the U.S. has more than 750 military bases in at least 80 countries worldwide. The actual number is probably higher, as the Pentagon has not published all the data. Washington entered the Middle East in a bid to hunt the man who they believe masterminded the 9/11 attacks. The Al-Qaeda leader Osama bin Laden, who was harbored by the Taliban in Afghanistan. They later invaded Iraq in 2003. Up to 3 million U.S. service members have served in Afghanistan and Iraq since 2001, with over half of them deployed more than once. The U.S. also has had an active military presence in Japan since the end of World War II and in South Korea since the Korean War in the 50s. Nearly half of the U.S. military forces deployed abroad are stationed in these two countries, with 80,000 service members. Elsewhere, Europe is home to some 60,000 American troops. Meanwhile, the U.S.'s most controversial and oldest military base abroad is located in Cuba, the Guantanamo Bay Naval Base. The U.S. has controlled the base since the end of 19th century. Since 2002, the naval base has contained a military prison to hold inmates in a place neither the U.S. nor international law applied. Since then, Guantanamo has been synonymous with human rights abuses perpetrated by the U.S. government in the name of terrorism.
Well, the impulse behind the United States transition from Republican democracy to empire started in the early 1990s with the fall of the Soviet Union, and that is when the acceleration of the U.S. military-based development expanded greatly, because the military-industrial complex, the general defense contractors, the bankers were seeking a transition to empire. And with the crumbling of the Soviet Union, they exploited these opportunities to try and position U.S. bases all around Russia, with the agenda to cannibalize it, and had the self-supporting delusion that the United States was now the heir apparent to dominate and control the world.
In 2020, the U.S. was the largest military spender in the world, and more than the next 10 countries combined, as it has spent $778 billion on its military. Over the past two decades, the U.S. has spent $8 trillion on its so-called war on terror, that only caused more instability across the globe. The U.S. military intervention as a whole is responsible for the creation of Daesh terrorists. If the U.S. hadn't invaded Iraq in 2003, and if Washington and its allies hadn't backed opposition groups and al-Qaeda affiliates in Syria, Daesh would never have formed. Following the 9/11 attacks and the declaration of war on Afghanistan in 2001 and Iraq in 2003, the U.S. saw a large spike in the number of its troops abroad. At least 800,000 Americans served in Afghanistan and more than 1.5 million in Iraq over the past 20 years. The human cost of the U.S. so-called war on terror is estimated to have killed more than 900,000 people, mostly civilians.
It not only violates the sovereignty of individual nations where the U.S. has forcibly impregnated itself in and established military bases in these countries, but it more importantly violates the fundamental core of our human existence. God made men and women to be free and to seek Him and to enjoy life on earth, not to exist as a slave to another. And the United States and its military expansion and its ambitions for bases really is a transformation of slavery.
It seems the U.S. aim behind all these military bases is to exert its own foreign policy directives under the pretext of policing the world. Although supported by international legal agreements, the presence of foreign troops violates a country's sovereignty.
The coronavirus pandemic has not only cost countless lives, but has hit the world economy hard. The United States, which has the world's biggest economy, hasn't been an exception. The U.S. is the world's worst-hit nation by the pandemic. Under former President Donald Trump, the country launched a program called Operation Warp Speed to facilitate and accelerate the production and distribution of COVID-19 vaccines. U.S. pharmaceutical companies developed several vaccines and rolled them out to the country's population. Trump's successor, Joe Biden's administration, set a target of vaccinating 70% of the country's population, at least partially, by the 4th of July. However, the country met the target a month later, despite generous incentives given to Americans.
to at least 40% of the U.S. population, is a victim of a lot of silly conspiracy theories about the vaccine and are adamant about not taking the vaccine. It's a big problem in the U.S. that's been stoked by social media and QAnon and, you know, career right-wing politicians who are manipulating it all for their personal gain. So the U.S. Is confronting with this real problem.
The vaccination program proved effective at bringing down the daily COVID cases and deaths, but up to a certain point. The highly infectious Delta variant of the coronavirus sent a new wave of cases and fatalities across the world. Scrambling to contain the spiraling outbreak, President Biden announced new mandatory vaccination plans on Thursday.
I will sign an executive order that will now require all executive branch federal employees to be vaccinated. All. And I've signed another executive order that will require federal contractors to do the same. If you want to work with the federal government and do business with us, get vaccinated.
But in addition to saving lives, the U.S. government is aiming at saving the economy, too.
Well, it certainly would help because we have a problem going on of a lot of workers not wanting to go back to work now that the COVID Delta variant is accelerating in a lot of places in the country. That was obvious in the last month's job report.
The mandatory vaccination program has triggered a backlash from American conservatives. Hours after the Democratic U.S. president announced a coronavirus vaccine mandate for federal workers, Republicans lambasted the decision, suggesting that it's unconstitutional. Figures, including Republican National Committee Chairwoman Ronna McDaniel, threatened to take legal action against the Biden administration. A majority of the critics are questioning the administration's authority to declare such a mandate. Back in March, the Democrats in the U.S. Congress passed a bill for a $1.9 trillion coronavirus stimulus package without a single vote from Republican lawmakers. The plan was intended to send direct payments of up to $1,400 per person to the majority of American households, extend a $300 per week unemployment insurance supplement, and put funds into vaccine distribution. The Republicans argued that the package was superfluous as the economy was reopening anyway. They believed the economy would suffer down the road, considering how big a figure the bill earmarked.
Well, you know, that's a false argument. What the Republicans are really about is that they don't want to spend on these stimulus programs because if the stimulus programs spending amounts to significant fiscal stimulus, then they'll have to raise taxes on corporations and investors, which means they'll have to reduce some of the generous Trump tax cuts of 2017. That gave $4.5 trillion in tax cuts to corporations and wealthy individuals and investors. They would have to raise taxes, and that's really what it's about. They don't want to raise those taxes. They don't want to take away the Trump tax cuts if they got to have to spend a lot on social programs.
With the United States COVID-19 figures rising in recent weeks, economic indicators are expected to be negatively impacted. Biden's unprecedented and aggressive move to make vaccines mandatory for a considerable portion of the American society can highlight the gravity of the risk the U.S. economy is currently facing from the deadly contagion.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant factor.
Imamat yek asl zinda ast dar tarikh Islam.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam,
and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, welcome to another episode of Ulama's Speech. Please accept our condolences on the martyrdom anniversary of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Hashemi Nejad about the master of the martyrs, Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. Stay tuned. Once, after 4 years of the demise of the late Allama Amini, the compiler of Al-Ghadir, he came to the dreams of his son. He was in the world of Barzakh or Purgatory. His son found that Allama Amini had a beautiful place in the world of Barzakh. The son asked his father, "What is the reason for your good and beautiful place here?" Allama Amini answered, "Paying ziyara to the tomb of Hussein ibn Ali in Karbala." The son answered, "All the roads towards Karbala are closed, and we cannot go there. What should we do?" Allama Amini answered, "Wherever you find the majlis of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, attend there, and Allah will give you the reward. Good for both the visitors of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam in Karbala, and those who have the chance of attending the majalis of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. O Abu Abdullah, I have come to you with all my hope. Please do not leave me alone." Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, for listening to this episode of Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Hashemi Nejad. To find out more about this program, please log on to our website, parstoday.com/en, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
IRIB English Radio.